Raise your hand, I want to make sure we get the question recorded, so if you have a question.
Pastor Lusk, thank you so much for coming all the way out here. This has been great. You had mentioned how so many male spaces have been just carved out of our cultural existence. And I'm wondering, what can we do about that? Do you have any practical advice for the kinds of male spaces that we could restore?
Yeah, I do, actually. So I think we've got some wonderful opportunities to do that. One, I would say, churches can very easily create male spaces. So churches should do it. You know, find things that men in your church like to do and then do it. And that can include, you know, reading and studying something together and the debate and discussion that comes out of that. It can include, you know, all kinds of other things. I think even short-term mission trips, you know, sending a group of men down to Peru, for example, to go work with Peru Mission would be a great, you know, male bonding type experience. I would say that. I would say if you ever do a school, you know, one thing I would love to do, if we did a school at my church, one thing I would love to do is do basically separate boys and girls schools and basically make education a male space and a female space. I think that's really helpful because I think an androgynous learning environment kind of feeds a big part of the problem we've got. You know, if you homeschool, you'd have to get creative with thinking about ways to sort of, you know, pull out sons and do this with them and pull out daughters and do this with them. But, you know, those kind of things I have in mind. And then hope that spills over to the culture. There is some interest in the broader culture in reclaiming male spaces. You know, things like the, you know, for example, the local tavern or pub, you know, used to be a largely male space. You know, even that kind of thing has been lost. As the culture's degenerated, those have become degenerate places. They weren't always that way. But I would say there are all kinds of other things we could do to create male spaces. And there's certainly some interest in this in the broader culture, and so maybe we can tap into that as well. Guys like Aaron Wren have done some writing on this, and so I could point you to their work, the kind of things they've said about it. But just in general, that's what I would say. You know, figure out how to do events for men in your church and build from that, and then see what that leads to.
Hey, Pastor Lusk. Last night you said that men's mission is basically building good things, maintaining good things, and destroying evil, basically, like the garden, keep and maintain pattern we see in Genesis. And in this talk, you really stressed the importance of male friendships. How in the modern world can men build and maintain good things together or destroy evil together? Like, we can't go fight Philistines, so what can we do?
Yeah. I wouldn't suggest that. And that's why I did point out that, you know, even in the old covenant, the kind of holy war that Israel wages when they come into the land is not a common thing. For most of Israel's history, the main war they were called to fight was a spiritual war, you could say. And that's how it is for us. Think about a passage like Ephesians 6. But I would say there are all kinds of things that we should be doing. I didn't make this point in the Judges 2 talk, but it's really interesting. In Judges 2, if you kind of look at the middle of that passage that I read, it talks about how when the angel of the Lord basically convicted the people of their sin, it says they wept and then they sacrificed. So basically, the angel of the Lord preaches a sermon. They realize, oh, we've failed. You know, we have compromised with the Canaanites covenantally, and so now our children are not being faithful, and so they weep and they sacrifice. So there's this humble contrition over sin, and then there's worship. And I think again and again in Scripture you see that when God's people are confronted with what they've done wrong, the first thing they do is humble themselves before the Lord and then worship. And so whatever we're going to build is going to be built on the platform of worship. We're talking about building blocks. What's the platform those building blocks rest on? It's gathered worship. I mean, because that's where the grace of God is given to us in its most concentrated form. That's where God renews covenant with us and strengthens us and equips us fundamentally. So everything else flows out of that. So that's where it starts. So the kind of things I said at the end of that second talk last night would be really important. You know, the best way a man can lead his family is leading them into Zion, where they can receive the Lord's blessing. And I'm, you know, again, I'm shocked at the number of Christian men who just won't make getting their family to church a priority. So they go on vacation and, well, we're on vacation, so we can take a vacation from God too. No, God's the Lord of your vacation too. Christ is Lord over your vacation time. Go to church on Sunday, you know, so figure those things out. So I would start with that kind of thing. And then I would say going out from there, it's just going to depend on each man's calling. So, you know, there's certainly things that we can do together. If you take my first talk seriously, you might say, you know what, maybe we need to raise up more men in our church who can run for office, you know, and start, you know, with something small and local and then build from there. And maybe that's a way to have influence. You know, and again, there's a lot of Christians who will look down on you and say, oh, you're just seeking power. And I would say, yeah, you know what, we are seeking power, and that's a really good thing to do. Okay, just like you go to your job because you're seeking money. You know, money and power are good things. They're good tools. They're things that we can use to do good in the world. And are they dangerous? Yes, money and power are dangerous. Everything in a fallen world is dangerous. Okay, but we should seek these things and then use them for good and use them in righteous ways. You know, I'd much rather have Christians on the ballot that I can vote for. Who have clear convictions about all of the issues of the day than the really kind of bland candidates that often have an R by their name, or the very, you know, anti-God, Christ-hating candidates that have a D by their name. So that kind of thing. But like I said, I think it would really just depend from one man to another what his particular calling is or what his particular vocation is. I mean, certainly these are all things that men can do in their families, but going beyond that, I would say whatever your vocation is, figure out how to do it faithfully and wisely as a Christian. And that's going to include competence and skill, and it's also going to include virtue. So a lot of times, Dorothy Sayers talks about this in one of her books, her book on work. You know, she talks about how sometimes we think, you know, like, what is the church's message to the carpenter? The church's message to the carpenter is tithe off whatever you earn, and don't go to the bars after work and get drunk. And she says, actually, the first thing we should be telling the carpenter is the way you glorify God is by making a really good table. And so pursue excellence. Pursue excellence in your craft, in your vocation. That's fighting against evil, because a lot of men are lazy in the work that they do. And it's also building something good, something useful, something valuable. So I would say men who become really excellent in their work, I will often put it this way. There's two things that a man has to consider: being a good man and being good at being a man. So being a good man has to do with virtue, being a virtuous man, doing the right thing, okay, fulfilling your obligations. Being good at being a man means having the kinds of skills and competencies that you need to do the things God has called you to do, particularly take dominion in some form, you know, some way in the world. In our world today, we've got a lot of men who are good at being men, but they're not good men. And we got a lot of good men who are not good at being men, okay? And we got to bring those back together. And I think that will really help.
Take a couple more. Question.
You mentioned in your education talk, 18 kids should be ready to kind of take on the world. Do you not see a danger in sort of just sending kids into the secular den of kind of the modern university in the same way that you would with the K-12 education?
I would say no, not in the same way. Now, I would say you still need to be smart about the dangers that are there. But the dangers are there anywhere you go when you're 18, basically. I mean, if your child at 18 goes and gets a job at a local restaurant, they're probably going to be around a bunch of degenerates there, too. And I would say if you send your kids to college somewhere, you certainly can send them to a Christian college. There are very few that are actually Christian in more than just name, where the curriculum and the culture is actually Christian. That's rare. Obviously, there's NSA, but that's a long way from here, and it's a long way from Birmingham. So that's something you have to think about. But I think that by the time your child is that age, they should be able to face, and if they're not, then I would say you got to do something different to sort of play catch up. But by that age, they should be ready to face what the world throws at them. They should be able to face the different kinds of temptations that might come with a university job or a corporate job or a job in the trades, and make good decisions. And if your child's not at a point where they're going to make good decisions, I would say then you need to figure something else out to get them where they are before you launch them out. But I would say, you know, the age 20 is kind of the turning point for adulthood in the Bible. If you think of a man taking on public responsibilities or communal responsibilities at age 20, according to Numbers chapter 1. So I'm backing that up a couple years, but I'd say somewhere in that 18 to 20 age range, they really should be able to face those things. I mean, so this is something that I remember Doug Wilson saying that I thought was really true, that basically by the time his kids, I want to say like maybe 16 or so, he basically said, all right, you can make your own decisions now. You decide what to watch. You decide how late to stay out, that kind of thing. Giving your kid a really long leash. And so you would see what they would do with it. And if they really mess up, then you can, you know, still jerk that leash back. So I would say parents who can do that with kids who are 16 or 17, if the kids handle that well, then you know your kid's ready to go out more or less, you know, and do whatever it might be that they're called to do by age 18 to 20. It's a little bit different with sons and daughters. Obviously, you're going to be much more protective with your daughters. So I think you have to be very careful about that. But even with your daughters, I mean, I think we ought to be raising girls who have their head on straight and can make good decisions and won't be easily swayed by the things going on in the world and the culture around them and that kind of thing. So,
well, there's so many topics I could zoom in on, but your first talk, I appreciated your emphasis on nations and covenants over ethnicity. And I think we, in our circles, we've rightly emphasized caring for our own, but I've been a little alarmed at how racism has been creeping in, I think particularly in our younger folks. I actually know a guy who says that if a white man were to marry a black woman or a white woman were to marry a black man, it would be sin. My question is, what can we be doing to positively combat this while still emphasizing the good and caring for our own? But combating racism, like what would you say to that?
Yeah, well, that's really good. So, I have seen some of these things too, and I've been very alarmed by the same kinds of things that you have that you mentioned there, and honestly, kind of surprised because, you know, for years, people that I know who are progressive would say, oh, you know, conservatives are just racist. And I'd say, no, I've been around these people all my life. You know, we're not racist. And now I'm like, well, there are some races kind of on the fringes at least. So that's frustrating to see that kind of crop up. But I think a lot of it is, you know, you demonize whites or you demonize the white male long enough and he kind of embraces that, and then that's unfortunate. That's an immature response. But I think that's part of what's happening. You also have a lot of people who they know they've been lied to. And so they just figure, well, I guess everything was a lie. And so if they, you know, they told me Robert E. Lee was bad, but I think he had a lot of virtue. They told me Adolf Hitler was bad too. You know, maybe he really was a Christian prince. But that's just not educated. I mean, that's not the way educated people think. You don't just react that way. You have been told a lot of lies. That doesn't mean that you should just believe the opposite of what you were told. You know, you have to be more discerning than that and actually put the work in. But when it comes to the racism, we just have to talk about the Bible. Because again, so how does the Bible address these issues? The Bible is largely colorblind. Okay, so if you were to ask the question, let's say you did not know that people came with different colored skin and you just read the Bible, could you figure that out from the Bible alone? Well, there's a few little places, you know, Song of Solomon talks about the dark skin of the beloved. Jeremiah talks about, could the Ethiopian change his skin? You know, I mean, there's a few little places like that, but there's no theological significance attributed to it. The Bible recognizes covenantal entities, nations, families, churches. And this is really, really important. So historically, our duties to our nation were taken up under the heading of the fifth commandment. Honoring your father and mother includes honoring even previous generations before them. And you not only have a father in your family to honor, you've got fathers in the church, in your church, you've got fathers in your nation. And so the nation's a covenantal entity with a covenantal head, a civil representative who is, you know, in a way you could say the civil father of that nation. Well, the white race doesn't have a covenantal head. The white race is not a covenantal entity. So there's no way that I can apply the fifth commandment to it. Basically, if the point is I'm supposed to care for my own, the lines in which that love and loyalty run should have very little to do with race. Again, family matters, ethnicity matters, and of course, you could say my greatest loyalty should be to the family of God, no question about that. But But obviously family and nation exists also. But there's just nothing about loyalty to a race in the Bible. There's nothing at all that would encourage that or even lead you to be conscious of that. Almost all of this, I would say the ancient world was a very racist place, but it was very racist in an ethnic kind of way. The racism was not based on skin color. It was a kind of, we just don't have a good word for it. I mean, you'd have to put ethnic in where race is and ethnism or something. I mean, that's not a word we have. It's a very racist place. And Aristotle talks about this, how the different races were very hostile to one another. Different people groups were very hostile to one another. And basically, Aristotle thought that for that reason, it was very important to keep the people groups separate. So, for example, the ancient city of Antioch, the one that's mentioned in the book of Acts, where Paul goes and does missionary work, the different people groups, it was a very ethnically diverse city. A lot of the, because of the way empires would do things when they took over people, they would just scatter them. That was a way of kind of breaking down loyalties and that kind of thing. But you ended up with a city like Antioch. So it's very cosmopolitan, but you got all these different people groups who have different ethnic backgrounds, and they all hate each other. And so basically they built walls in the city of Antioch to basically keep these people from killing each other, almost like they had to cage them up, okay? I mean, think about like an American city where there's Chinatown and there's the Polish part of town and the Italian part of town and that kind of thing. But imagine walls having to be built to keep them from fighting with each other, okay? That's the kind of thing you have. Paul goes in, plants a church, and people are coming from all these different groups and joining his church. And the very thing that Aristotle said could not happen is now happening in the church, okay? So the church broke down those kinds of hostilities and really created a new humanity. It doesn't mean that people left their former ethnic group or all of their ties behind altogether, but it does mean that their loyalty to, say, that ethnic group was relativized by a greater loyalty they now have to the people of God. And it does mean that they're going to fulfill their obligations and play their role within that ethnic group in a different kind of way now that they're a believer. So it transforms the way we look at that. Okay, so think about something like this. And this is why we have to think in terms of ethnicity and not race. Paul says, he's actually quoting a proverb when he writes to Titus, and he says, all Cretans are liars and gluttons, okay? Well, okay, so he says this about Cretans, okay? But Cretans are Caucasians. I mean, they were Greeks, okay? They were Caucasians. Is Paul saying that all white people are liars and gluttons? Is that what? No, he's talking about an ethnic group. Okay, Paul does not think in terms of skin color. He thinks in terms of ethnicity. That's just a different thing. So when we see, so a lot of this, you know, a lot of this goes back to Aristotle and the church overcame it. And then it started again with Darwin, you know, and Darwin sort of provided a, you know, with social Darwinism kind of provided a reason for people to become racist again. And what I think you're seeing happen today in the church with this, these kind of fringe people who are kind of digging this stuff back up, it's maybe more due to Aristotle than it is to Darwin, but it is the same kind of thing, and we have to push back in the same kind of way and just say that's not biblical. That is not a biblical way to think. And it's like I said at the end of my talk, it's unbiblical, and it's also bound to lose. So what strikes me as interesting is the very same men who are obsessed with so-called winning, like they want to win, that we want to win down here, those are the very often the same men that will adopt these kinds of positions, and that's going to lose. So if you say you want to win, why adopt something that is bound to lose? I mean, you know, the left will accuse Donald Trump of being a racist. I don't think he is. But one thing I appreciate about Trump is that he's never tried to play the identity politics game. And in fact, he's done just the opposite. And I think it's one reason why he's had quite a bit of success, more success than a lot of Republican presidential candidates, in getting the what you could call the minority vote, because he has not done the racial identity politics game. And then you've got these young men who come along, oh, we're going to, you know, we want a white Christian nationalism. Well, no, that's just dumb. That you can't have a white Christian nationalism, because that's not the way it works. It's contradictory. So I think we just have to push back hard and hope that particularly these young men who are thinking that way will be willing to listen to the scripture and learn. I think that's what we have to do.
Okay, well, one more. Anybody? No? Good. Okay, I think.
Yeah, so I would say define ethnicity. Okay, so I would say that a nation is a a definable people group that generally has a shared way of life, some degree of shared kinship, a shared language, and most of the time, and a shared government, and most of the time has a geographic place they share. That one gets a little bit fuzzy sometimes, but the other things are more definable. So it's really, so you know, you think about those things, the things that, so when the Great Commission is framed in terms of disciple the ethne, disciple the nations, I think that's what Jesus means. The different people groups defined by shared government, shared culture, shared language, shared borders. That's basically it. Okay, now this is what's interesting. This ties in with the other question too. Here's another way to think about this. Okay. When God judges a nation, what does that look like? Okay. In the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 28, God says that he's going to send to the Israelites. Well, this is actually, you can even go back further. In Deuteronomy 28, it talks about this, one of the curses of the covenant, okay? But in Isaiah 28, Isaiah picks up on this, and basically what Isaiah says, more or less, or what God says through Isaiah is, you have not listened when I have given you prophets speaking your own language, and so I'm going to send foreign invaders who speak a different language, and maybe that'll get your attention and you'll repent, okay? So when people come into your land speaking a different language, a language you don't understand, that's judgment, okay? That's true even in Acts chapter 2. People sometimes say, well, didn't Pentecost reverse all that? No. Actually, in Acts chapter 2, when tongues happen at Pentecost, it's both a sign of blessing and curse. It's blessing to the Gentiles, showing that now the covenant's being opened up to the Gentiles. So Gentiles, as Gentiles, can come in and be, you know, full status children of Abraham in the church. But tongues being spoken in Jerusalem, that is a sign of judgment against unbelieving Israel. And actually, Paul picks up on that in 1 Corinthians 14, and he says, tongues are a sign not to believers, but to unbelievers. He means unbelieving Jews. Tongues are a sign that judgment is coming on Israel. And of course, that judgment was fulfilled in 70 AD. So when God judges a nation, that's never described in terms of people of a different skin color coming in. It's described in terms of people of a different language. That tells you that's one ethnicity overtaking another. It's one nation invading another. So that's the way to think about it. Language is a more basic category in the Bible than race. You know, so you think about it like, so I'm white, but there are lots of white people who don't speak my language, don't have my religion, don't have my worldview, don't live within the same geographic borders I do. I'm not a people in any deep sense with other whites who live in, you know, say Romania, okay? But there is such a thing as Romania. Romania really exists, and Romania exists in the sight of God. And there is such a thing as the United States of America, and the United States of America really does exist in the sight of God. So ethnicity and race have to be distinguished. Same thing I was saying about the Cretans. If you don't distinguish ethnicity and race, then Paul is saying all white people are liars and gluttons. You have to make that distinction. Okay, so does that answer your question? So, yeah. Okay. Thank you, Virgil.